It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the cinemas and on DVD. Get ready for...
Wait for it!
Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Sozi!
No, that's Matthew Sozi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's find out how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sozi.
Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. And I'm also on Facebook. And this show is available as a podcast and on Monday afternoons, and of course it is also available through iTunes. Thank you, Melissa. Well, we're going to have a different show this week. I will make a note that opening in theaters in Indianapolis this weekend, the film's Mural, the Robert Redford political drama, The Conspirator, the animated film Rio, and Scream 4. And new on DVD this week, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1 and the Gwyneth Paltrow drama Country Strong. There, you've been updated. This week's show is dedicated to the filmography and memory of director Sidney Lumet, who died on April 9th at the age of 86. I'll be playing for you an interview I did with Jeff Marker, assistant professor of Gainesville State College, as well as a columnist for The Times in Gainesville and co-host of the Daily FilmFix.com. We'll be talking about the work of Sidney Lumet, and then we'll hear an audio medley tribute featuring some of the films directed by Sidney Lumet. He was nominated 4 times for an Academy Award, was given an honorary Oscar, and full disclosure, one of my favorite directors. Some of the titles you probably know, and if you don't, you really should. His debut feature film job as a director was 12 Angry Men. Some of the other titles include Long Day's Journey and Tonight, The Pawnbroker, Failsafe, The Hill, The Group, The Seagull, The Anderson Tapes, The Offense, Serpico, Murder on the Orient Express, Dog Day Afternoon, Network, Equus, The Wiz, Just Tell Me What You Want, Prince of the City, Death Trap, The Verdict, Daniel, Garbo Talks, The Morning After, Running on Empty, Family Business, Q&A, Gloria, remake of Gloria, Night Falls on Manhattan, Find Me Guilty, and his last film, which he directed at the age of 83, and I remember because this film made my top 10, my top 5 actually, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. That is one hell of a list of films to direct in one career, in one lifetime. So he will definitely, definitely be missed. And, of course, also was the author of Making Movies, which is probably the best book about filmmaking. It's not gossip, and it's not Hollywood Babylon. It's just about the making process. Lumet started out in television. He also started out directing on the stage. So he always, always had 2 weeks' worth of rehearsals before filming. He was a favorite among actors. Some of the people's best performances, some actors' best performances came from Sidney Lumet films, I think immediately, of Paul Newman in The Verdict, Treat Williams in Prince of the City, and many, many others. So if you don't know any Sidney Lumet films, you should go find some. And if you haven't seen some of his work in a while, it's worth revisiting, I assure you. All right, we're going to hear a conversation I had recently, yesterday, with Jeff Marker, who is an assistant professor of film and film studies at Gainesville State College. He's a columnist for The Times in Gainesville, and he's also a co-host of the online review segment DailyFilmFix.com. So, Jeff, tell me about your first Sidney Lumet film experience, whether you knew who he was at the time or not.
Well, I didn't know who he was at the time because the first time I saw one of his movies, I was only 7. Nor did I really know what a director did, you know, or what that title even really meant. But I still, to this day, remember watching Murder on the Orient Express. And there I am at 7 years old, And that was sort of the year that I discovered movies anyway. And I just remember sort of being taken by this neat little murder mystery. And yes, I probably used the word neat when I was seven. And, you know, to give you an idea of the impression it made on me, I still remember seeing that. But the other movie that year that really made a big impression on me was I went to the drive-in and saw Star Wars for the first time.
Wow.
I think it says something about Lumet's direction, his filmmaking, that, you know, he didn't need spaceships and lightsabers to keep me interested.
Right. Now,
it was just a great story.
Now, was this your first encounter with a mystery? Because other than those meddling kids and the darn dog.
Yeah, right, exactly. And we'll reveal our ages here. There was no cable when I was seven, you know, and so you pretty much had Saturday mornings. I ignored all the things in the afternoon and evenings, and then some things at night. And so it was one of the first sort of live action, not necessarily made for kids movies I ever saw.
Right. We call them grown up movies because adult movies sounds bad.
Yeah. That's not what this call is about.
No. And I think also looking back, that might have been one of the best all-star movies from the 70s, because there was a lot of disaster movies with the all-star cast with the little mugshots at the bottom of the poster, and this was definitely no disaster. And also the fact that there, you know, I guess, do we do a spoiler alert on a near 40-year-old film? The twist at the end, I don't think had been done before.
No, I don't think so either. And the other thing, of course, I wouldn't have had this frame of reference then either, but I look back and I love the end, not only the twist at the end. See how I glossed over the spoiler?
Yeah.
But I also love the sort of theatrical curtain call at the end of that movie, too.
Yeah, his homage to his theater, which, you know, he's always was able to do. I mean, you hear those wonderful stories that he had 2 weeks of rehearsal before filming. Actors loved to work with him. Of course, he, you know, had experience on the stage and on 50s television, where it was all theatrical.
Right. And he manages to do what a lot of people who begin with a theatrical background aren't able to do, and that's make an actual movie. We're not just watching a stage play from, you know, the 10th row out or something like that. He understood how to frame his camera to sort of make it more cinematic and capture moments that in a way that only movies can.
My first experience with him, of course, I think at that time I remember seeing on TV Peter Finch screaming in Network and Al Pacino screaming in Dog Day Afternoon. But I remember I was 11 when my dad took me to see Prince of the City. And I think that was one of the first grown-up cop dramas I saw. And that's a 2-hour and 40-minute film. But even for a caffeinated middle schooler, it was still fairly easy to follow. And that's a dense movie with a lot of scenes and a lot of actors.
Yeah, it is. And it's also one of those, in a way, I don't think anybody calls that his best film ever, but it's one of those sort of quintessential Lumet films, too, because New York is as much of a character as any of the human actors.
Do you think, and I know this would stir a lot of hornet's nests, but some people have considered him the New York director. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I understand why people say that, but frankly, I think that's a little limiting, because really, even though the real story in Dog Day Afternoon happened in New York, it didn't have to happen there necessarily. It kind of makes sense with the media, but it could have been transferred. And the fact is, it could be in a bank anywhere, and it would still be just as powerful. Prince of the City, Serpico, Pawnbroker, those are very much New York films. But 12 Angry Men, possibly, I would argue the best courtroom drama ever, could be in a courtroom anywhere in the world. We get the inside view of the TV industry in Network, but New York isn't really much of a character in that movie. And, you know, his films are merely about a good chestnut of a story and character consistently. You know, when
right.
He hits his high point, it becomes about something that's a bit more broad and something that sort of reflects something cultural. But very few of his movies, when you really break it down, rely on New York City.
Right. At least he didn't set Equus in New York City.
Very true.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, the other director, of course, that gets associated with New York City is Woody Allen, and I think he's made some pretty darn good movies that aren't set in New York, and so did Lumet.
Oh, wait a minute, right now, hold if you listen very carefully, Spike Lee's complaining.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Lee.
That's all right. Now, so you, Murder on the Orient Express, when did you start to seek out, or when was it that you realized that you were watching a Sidney Lumet film? Because it sort of happened with Prince of the City, and then his follow-up film, and what a hell, or, no, it wasn't his follow-up film, then there was Death Trap, and then The Verdict, and The Verdict blew me away for a 12-year-old.
Well, good for you that The Verdict held your attention at age 12. Well, this goes back to, you know, growing up in a rural area. We finally did get cable, and 12 Angry Men ended up being shown on, you know, whatever. And that was about the time, and I think you and I, we didn't know each other then, but I think we were sort of on similar paths. You know, we started realizing that we were geeks at about middle school. And so, yeah, I wanted to know. You know, 12 Angry Men, you can be six or 76 and be entranced by that movie. You know, you should be at least. And so I don't think if you're sort of on the verge of adulthood, I don't think you can watch 12 Angry Men and not realize that, you know, somebody made this happen. These actors are wonderful in front, but there are a couple of shots that call attention to themselves too. And of course, the most famous is that slow tracking shot backward as, you know, the bigot in the room sort of has his final explosion and the other 11 men turn their backs on him. And if you're paying attention at any age, you have to realize somebody made that decision and made that moment that much more powerful with the camera.
And that was a debut. That was a feature film debut. We should all have a debut so strong.
Yeah, I forget that, actually. That has to be considered one of the best debut films ever.
So, and of course, yeah, like you said, we had cable and, you know, video stores were starting to pop up. So, yeah, we couldn't go to a library or Netflix and bang out the entire Sidney Lumet filmography. So it was kind of a combination of what films came to theaters and what came up on television. Because that's where I was able to see 12 Angry Men and Failsafe and The Pawnbroker, which, by the way, not a date film, despite the music by Quincy Jones. But I think Lumet had one of those careers that, especially after he died, when you look at his filmography, if you're just a novice, you're like, wow, he did all that. And he's not always in the Scorsese, another New York director, Scorsese, Spielberg, you know, pantheon of great filmmakers. I think part of it maybe is because he stayed in New York, but he didn't have a style per se. I think maybe it's, you know, the style of not having a style.
Yeah, and this could get you into a big discussion on what exactly is an auteur or what is a great director. And, you know, I think most people define a great director or a real film artist as somebody who has a definite trademark style. It shows up film after film. You recognize that you're watching a film by this person no matter what it is. And on the one hand, Lumet, from one perspective, Lumet did not have that. But from another perspective, I think the people who say that are wrong. You know, this past week, as I know you have and lots of other film lovers have, I've gone back and watched some, you know, rewatched his films, and you know, here at in my middle years, it's easier to pick up on all those things that I didn't necessarily when I first encountered those movies as a teenager and in my early 20s and that sort of thing. And I think he had a definite style. He favored long takes. It's not necessarily, you know, acrobatic camera movement and things like that, but he had very motivated camera movements. You know, he loved that slow tracking, sort of tracking backwards to reveal somebody or something. He does it brilliantly in The Verdict in a moment that I won't spoil. And so he does those sorts of things over and over again. The thing that he didn't do was, you know, no offense to the Quentin Tarantinos and Martin Scorsese's of the world, or even the Paul Thomas Andersons of the world, all of whom I admire and like very much, he didn't, Lumet didn't feel the need to impress you with what he does necessarily. It always grew out of the material.
I agree on that. That's you're right. They were not drawing attention to oneself.
Exactly. And the other thing is, he didn't brand himself like Hitchcock and Tarantino and the others either.
No, you look at, yeah, you forget, and I remember you and I were talking, we'll get to it in a little bit, but yeah, he was able to cross over and do some comedies, although they're not the first thing that comes to mind, and, you know, is able to do a couple of courtroom dramas, a couple of cop dramas, and get his own twist on those, I guess I'll bring it up right now. There's a list I have of Lumet, and there's a section called Nobody's Perfect. And, you know, Lumet was one of those actors that, they were one of those directors that tried to do a musical in the 70s, and it didn't work, but he gave it a shot nonetheless.
But these days, and you're talking about The Wiz.
Yeah, I'm talking about The Wiz, where every dollar is on screen.
Yes, it is. And it's all painted gold, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. However, even The Wiz was well executed for what he was trying to do. It was just sort of a bad concept to begin with.
When I would say a little bit better than, say, John Huston's Annie or Sir Richard Attenborough's A Chorus Line, Scorsese's New York, New York, which I still will kind of defend.
I'm not. Here's my diplomatic answer. I'm not the musical expert, so I'm not going to. I live with a musical expert, and so I'm not going to, you know, start an argument at home by choosing any of those.
Okay. And of course, Death Trap, which we're doing spoiler alerts on 30 old films. You know, the one single take, the one moment, which Christopher Reeve and Michael Caine said to Sydney, "You're only getting this once, so make it count." Here's a piece of trivia. Did you know he worked with Sean Connery five times?
I didn't.
I took a look at this. The Hill, which I actually have, and is really good. And it was one of Connery's breaks from the James Bond series, and nobody saw it. Murder on the Orient Express, The Anderson Tapes, The Offense, and Family Business, which I only remember because it's one of my favorite cinematic gene pools. When the grandson is Matthew Broderick, his dad is Dustin Hoffman, and his grandfather is Sean Connery. What do the women look like in this film?
Yeah, you know, The Offense is the one that I always forget with Connery.
And a young Ian McShane.
Oh, wow. I bet he had the wonderful voice even back then.
Yes, he did. Now, there were a couple of comedies that I still have not seen from start to finish, and I know you watched one recently. It was Garbo Talks. There was also Just Tell Me What You Want with Ally McGraw and Alan King. What do you remember about Garbo Talks?
Well, Anne Bancroft, mostly.
Yeah.
You see how his style didn't really translate into comedy, and I hate to say that, because I think by all accounts he was a joyous person, you know, wasn't nearly as brooding as some of his movies might tend to be, but when he makes a comedy, he still sort of kept the same sort of deliberate pace. And for drama, you really sort of extend a moment and the impact of it sets in, but in a comedy, I think we're looking for another joke a little bit sooner than that, you know, and it was maybe a little bit drier than a lot of people wanted. However, there are these great scenes in Garbo Talks. There's a scene early on that, you know, Anne Bancroft plays this sort of one of those quintessential New Yorkers that show up in his films now and then. She's a sort of activist, kooky mother of the film who is obsessed with Greta Garbo. And so she and her son, who's played by Ron Silver, and he's just constantly sort of embarrassed by her, they're walking down the street, and there's a construction site, and the construction workers begin yelling all these lewd things at these young women who were walking up ahead of Bancroft and Silver there. And, of course, you know, Anne's character is outraged. And so she hops on this mechanical lift and goes up to where the construction workers are, you know, in a very dangerous little work site. And all these lewd things that they yelled at the other sort of, you know, hot young woman, she says, okay, well, she didn't come up, and I'm coming up. And so there she is, you know, 60-something, offering to do all these just, you know, very overtly, like, crude sexual things with all these construction workers. And so, you know, in a couple minutes, it's hilarious, and she completely puts these construction workers in their place. And so there are a handful of scenes in the movie like that. And the reason I think it doesn't play as well as a lot of his others is just we're sort of looking for more of those scenes a little bit more often. But it's definitely worth it to go back and take a look at, I think.
And we should all be berated by Anne Bancroft.
Yes, what a great way to be put in your place.
Mel Brooks, very lucky man. I think of another early one, and I don't know if this is probably not the best starting point, but we talked before about he's an actor's director. You look at how many actors got nominated for awards working with him. I think my favorite Katharine Hepburn performance came from Lamette in Long Day's Journey Into Night back in 1962, because it was the transition of young Katharine Hepburn, you know, when the morphine kicked in, and the, you know, old Katharine Hepburn, which everybody imitates to this dying day.
Yes.
Have you seen it?
Not in years, I have to admit, but I sort of know where it is in his career, and that's one of the last sort of stage adaptations that he did, and that's really what most of his early career was all about. He did a lot of TV work, but then he started doing those, you know, sort of filmed plays for TV, and sort of found, I think that's that period when he found his way to actually make a movie rather than just filming the play.
Yeah, I was looking at his IMDb, I wish some of these TV movies would come out, but he did a TV movie version of All the King's Men, he did The Iceman Cometh, he even did Rashomon, Iceman Cometh and Rashomon, both in 1960. So hopefully Criterion will get going on that.
Yeah, I saw Rashomon on his list, and I think that's a quest that you and I should undertake, is to get that one on a disc or streaming somewhere sometime in the future.
I agree. We'll get on that. Also, the fact that I love directors who were still pumping out quality work in their 60s, 70s, and even 80s. He was 83 when he made his last film, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, which made my top five, I remember, that year, not just because of the opening scene. But also he was also willing to work with digital cameras. So, you know, he was able to pull down his black socks and let the kids stay on his lawn.
Yeah, I was very much impressed by that, too. Because digital, you know, it just does not respond to light the way that film does. And here he is at 83, willing to work it out, you know, willing to film in a completely new format. The whole world would have forgiven him just for sort of making lackluster movies and sort of standing on his own reputation. But no, he tried something, even on the level of filming on a new format. But that is a really risky movie.
Yeah.
Risky for everybody involved, by the way. I mean, we keep referring, you know, kind of
the moment.
Cheek.
Yeah.
Huh?
The moment.
Yeah. The moment in the... In the opening scene, or
yeah, the opening scene where mankind cheered,
right? Yes, capital mankind cheered. There's that. It was risky for Marissa Tomei to do that, but it's risky to make a film that ends the way that one does as well.
Oh, big time! What a dark, dark way to end the picture.
Yeah, and really, that one's new enough that, you know, we don't want to come anywhere in the neighborhood.
Oh man, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it really does, and I hope I'm not just sort of becoming a fan at this point by looking at it and giving it this level of praise, but it really does strike me as something that Shakespeare would have written, set among a royal family with all the little intrigue, only it's sort of brought down to this working-class contemporary family, and yet it works.
Mm-hmm. And it should also be noted, he got Vin Diesel to act again in Find Me Guilty.
Again? Or...
Well, there was, yeah. I guess there was some promise in Private Ryan.
Yeah, forget about, I just forget Diesel was in that. But you're right. You are correct. I'll go along with you on that one.
For once. All right. Where if people need to take a Sidney Lumet 101, where do you have them start?
Gosh. I think if you take a look at Dog Day Afternoon first, you're bound to be hooked. You may stick with his greats. You know, stick with Dog Day Afternoon. Go to Network. If you want to know, if you like John Grisham to any degree, you need to watch The Verdict, because basically what Grisham and the directors who have adapted him have done their entire, you know, done the whole time is basically rip off Verdict, you know?
Right.
That's his whole career right there. And so if you like that sort of story, definitely go to The Verdict. But you know, you get away from his sort of what are considered his high points, and you go to things like Prince of the City, and even something I kind of enjoyed, Family Business, actually, and Running on Empty. This is another sort of portrait of, okay, what happened to those militant people in the 70s? Well, in the 80s, they're on the run,
right?
Not handling it very well, and those sorts of things. And so I would rather give people a list, okay, don't start here, but then here are 20 others that you're bound to be good with.
Right. I agree with you on Dog Day Afternoon. I definitely would put in Network because, well, it's more relevant today probably than ever.
Did I leave that one out? Did I not say Network?
Well, you just did.
Okay.
And maybe a double feature of Dr. Strangelove and Failsafe.
Very good.
Yeah, probably, and definitely 12 Angry Men and The Verdict. And some people will say if it weren't for Ben Kingsley, Newman would have got his first Oscar a few years prior.
Very likely. That's, well, gosh, I just watched that again a few nights ago, and what an extraordinary role for him. I don't remember ever seeing Newman defeated, you know?
Or, yeah, that vulnerable.
Exactly. You know, you see him in that one long shot. Again, it's a subtle decision. He's sitting, he's just standing there playing pinball, drink waiting for him on the windowsill, and it takes this one long take for Lamette to let us know that, man, this guy has been beaten by the world, and he's lost at this point. And Newman, of course, plays it perfectly.
And we're going to hear a little bit later on in the show, I did an audio medley, and his closing arguments, which is also another long shot. And you can hear him sighing in between, before and after his, you know, after he sits down. Yeah, even then, Newman was kind of like one of the guys growing up. And yeah, to see him that vulnerable, that defeated, that disheveled, was a real eye opener. Plus, it also helps if you have David Mamet doing the screenplay.
Right, and I had forgotten that was one of those early Mamet scripts too.
I guess the other thing, I got to get it out there because, well, it's my show. But another part that's going to be of the medley is the brilliant one scene with Ned Beatty in Network. It's going to be so unfair when that man dies, morning radio, and everybody else is going to bring up Deliverance, and the guy got a nomination for that and is amazing.
Yeah, and the other thing that's kind of unfair to him is, darn that Peter Finch.
And Beatrice Straight, and, you know, the others who got a lot. Because everybody got, you know, they got nominated. William Holden, Faye Dunaway won. Yeah, that's not a bad track record for a cast.
Yeah, and Beatty only has that one scene, but it's a magnificent scene. I mean, he's in a couple of others, but that's Beatty's tour de force scene. And, yeah, his bad luck is that, you know, these other actors had more tour de force scenes than he did. But, you know, even if you don't care about the media and all that sort of thing, and, you know, Network, if you're completely unfamiliar with it, basically in a couple of hours tells the whole story of how our visual news media kind of went in the tank. It captures that moment perfectly. But forget about all of that. You just do have this great script and these wonderful actors delivering it.
I couldn't have ended that better. Jeff Marker, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure to talk to you and to talk about Sidney Lumet.
That was Jeff Marker, assistant professor at Gainesville State College, a columnist for The Times in Gainesville, and co-host of DailyFilmFix.com. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, an audio tribute, an audio medley of some of the films directed by Sidney Lumet. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Welcome back to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook. You can tell me what your favorite Sidney Lumet film is. We are paying tribute to director Sidney Lumet, who died on April 9th at the age of 86. We heard an interview with Jeff Marker, a fellow film critic down in the Gainesville, Georgia area. And now, an audio medley, an audio tribute to just some of the films directed by Sidney Lumet. You'll recognize, hopefully, some of these in film clips, including Network, Dog Day Afternoon, The Wiz, Equus, The Verdict. Enjoy.
It's always difficult to keep personal prejudice out of a thing like this. Wherever you run into it, prejudice always obscures the truth. I don't really know what the truth is. I don't suppose anybody will ever really know.
Right? Robbing a bank's a federal offense. They got me on kidnapping, armed robbery. They're gonna bury me, man. I don't want to talk to somebody who's trying to calm me. Get somebody in charge here.
I am in charge.
I don't
want
to talk to some flunky pig trying to calm me.
You're not.
I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Among users of the drug, a marijuana cigarette is referred to as reefer, stick, roach, joint. The drug itself is referred to as pot, tea, boo, stuff,
Bill. You know, so much of the time we're just lost. Say, please, God, tell us what is right. Tell us what is true. I mean, there is no justice. The rich win, the poor are powerless. We become tired of hearing people lie. And after a time, we become dead. A little dead. We think of ourselves as victims. And we become victims. We become weak. We doubt ourselves. We doubt our beliefs. We doubt our institutions. And we doubt the law. But today you are the law. You are the law. Not some book, not the lawyers, not a marble statue, or the trappings of the court. See, those are just symbols of our desire to be just. They are, in fact, a prayer. A fervent and a frightened prayer. In my religion, they say, act as if you had faith. Faith will be given to you. If we are to have faith in justice, we need only to believe in ourselves and act with justice. See, I believe there is justice in our hearts.
It's you guys starting with assistant DAs who run the whole thing while we're up in El Barrio on 125th Street. Well, you're just out to hurt us. You want to lay the whole system on us, but nobody cares about me but my partner. It's me and him and whatever guy we catch, and we're gonna put him in jail, and we're gonna take his money. I know what you guys think of us, but we're the only thing between you and the jungle.
His name is Detective Danny Cello.
We make cases, they'll be big ones. You'll be the state star witness.
He sees life as we will never see it.
If I decide to do this thing, I will not give up my partners.
He is Prince of the City.
Detective Daniel Cello, Special Investigating Unit, Narcotics Division, Your Honor.
Is it common practice to sell narcotics in the Narcotics Division?
We're not dope dealers, we're policemen.
He's seen too much.
Was Moscone a partner?
He's a friend.
He's federal level. I want him.
He knows too much.
Your people are out to get you worse than anybody on our side.
He said too much.
In their hearts, they want to admit their guilt. That's the way cops are. That's how you got here.
He's gone too far to stop.
Wait a minute, I'm a cop!
Come on, up! Look at him!
Treat Williams is Prince of the City.
Ecstasy in the spiritless waste around him. All right. He's destroyed for it. Horribly. He's virtually been destroyed by it. But one thing I know for sure, that boy has known a passion more ferocious than I have known in any second of my life. And let me tell you something, I envy it.
You can't.
Don't you see? That's what his stare has been saying to me all this time. At least I galloped. When did you?
I'm jealous, Hester. Jealous of Alan Strang.
That's absurd.
Is it?
Yes, utterly. Utterly.
I go on about my wife. Have you thought about the husband? The finicky, critical husband with his art books on mythical Greece. What worship has he ever known? Real worship. Without worship, you shrink. It's as brutal as that. I shrank my own life. No one can do it for you. I settled for being pallid and provincial out of my own eternal timidity. The old story of bluster and do bugger all. I didn't even dare to have children. Didn't dare to bring children into a house, a marriage as cold as mine. I tell everyone, Margaret's the Puritan, I'm the pagan, some pagan. Such wild returns I make to the womb of civilization. 3 weeks a year in the Mediterranean. Every bed booked in advance, every meal paid for with vouchers, cautious jaunts in hired cars, suitcase crammed with kaopectate. What a fantastic surrender to the primitive. And the primitive, I use that word endlessly. Ah, the primitive world, I say. What instinctual truths were lost with it. And while I sit there baiting that poor, unimaginative woman with the word, that freaky boy is trying to conjure the reality. I look at pages of centaurs trampling the soil of Argos, and outside my window that boy is trying to become one in a Hampshire field. I sit there night after night watching that woman knitting, a woman I haven't kissed in 6 years. And he stands for an hour in the dark, sucking the sweat off his god's hairy cheek. Then in the morning I put away my books on the cultural shelf, close up my Kodachrome snaps of Mount Olympus, touch my reproduction statue of Dionysus for luck, and go off to the hospital to treat him for insanity. Now, do you see?
So, what do you propose, Mr. President?
Do your people think there is still a chance of bringing down the bombers?
There is always a chance. But I am asking you, what if they cannot? What will you do? Have you made a decision?
Yes. It's my decision, and I take full responsibility. Mr. Swenson, are you on the line?
Yes, Mr. President.
General Bolden?
Yes, sir.
This is what will happen if even one of the bombers gets through. It will drop 2 20-megaton bombs on Moscow. Jay?
Yes, Mr. President.
You might hear the sound of the engines just before the bombs drop. Maybe not. In any case, you'll hear the defensive missiles going off. Right after that, the bombs will explode. I'm told that what we will hear at this end will be a high, shrill sound. That will be the ambassador's phone melting from the heat of the fireball. When we hear that sound, the ambassador will be dead. You understand, Mr. Ambassador, you're to stay exactly where you are.
Yes, Mr. President.
He's got to attack.
Is this your proposal? To sacrifice one American for 5 million Russians?
No, no, no. Listen. I've ordered a Vindicator bomber into the air from Washington. In a few minutes, it will be flying over New York City. It is carrying 2 20-megaton bombs. The moment I know that Moscow has been hit, I will order that plane to drop its bombs. It will use the Empire State Building for ground zero. When we hear the shriek of Mr. Lentov's phone melting, we will know that he is gone, and with him New York.
Only one from God. Oh. He can't do it. This was nobody's fault.
I don't agree.
No human being did wrong. No one is to be blamed.
We're to blame, both of us. We let our machines get out of hand.
Still, it was an accident.
Two great cities may be destroyed. Millions of innocent people killed. What do we say to them, Mr. Chairman? Accidents will happen. I won't accept that.
All I know is that as long as we have weapons...
All I know is that men are responsible. We're responsible for what happens to us. Today we had a taste of the future. Do we learn from it or do we go on the way we have? What do we do, Mr. Chairman? What do we say to the dead?
I think if we are men, we must say this will not happen again. But do you think it possible? With all that stands between us.
We put it there, Mr. Chairman, and we're not helpless. What we put between us, we can remove.
Mr. President?
Yes, Jay?
I can hear the sound of explosions from the northeast. The sky is very bright. All lit up.
Put me through to General Black.
Yes, Mr. President.
Blackie.
Yes, Mr. President.
Moscow's been destroyed. Drop your bombs according to plan.
So there's nothing more to say. I have only one last order. Nobody else has to have anything to do with the dropping of the bombs. Repeat, I will fly the plane and release the bombs. Final act is mine.
On course, sir. Approaching target.
Down from 10, give me the signal. Down. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, mark.
General Black!
Me. get back
over
there.
What are you moving in there for?
Will you get back there? Huh? Get back
What's
there.
What's he doing? Look at him.
Get over there.
Go back there, man.
Get over there. Will you?
He wants to kill me so bad he can taste it.
Oh, God, I wasn't going to kill
him. Attica! Attica!
What are you
doing? Attica! 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 Attica!
Of nature, Mr. Beale, and I won't have it. Is that clear? You think you merely stopped a business deal? That is not the case. The Arabs have taken billions of dollars out of this country, and now they must put it back. It is ebb and flow, tidal gravity. It is ecological balance. You are an old man who thinks in terms of nations and peoples. There are no nations. There are no peoples. There are no Russians. There are no Arabs. There are no third worlds. There is no West. There is only one holistic system of systems. One vast and immane, interwoven, interacting, multivariate, multinational dominion of dollars. Petrodollars, electrodollars, multidollars, Reichmarks, rims, rubles, pounds, and shekels. It is the international system of currency which determines the totality of life on this planet.
That is the natural order of things today. That is the atomic and subatomic and galactic structure of things today. And you have meddled with the primal forces of nature. And you will atone. Am I getting through to you, Mr. Beale? You get up on your little 21-inch screen and howl about America and democracy. There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today. What do you think the Russians talk about in their councils of state? Karl Marx? They get out their linear programming charts, statistical decision theories, min-max solutions, and compute the price-cost probabilities of their transactions and investments, just like we do. We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies, Mr. Beale. The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime. And our children will live, Mr. Beale, to see that perfect world in which there's no war or famine, oppression or brutality. One vast and ecumenical holding company for whom all men will work to serve a common profit, in which all men will hold a share of stock, all necessities provided, all anxieties tranquilized, all boredom amused. And I have chosen you, Mr. Beale, to preach this evangel.
Why me?
Because you're on television, dummy. 60 million people watch you every night of the week, Monday through Friday.
I have seen the face of God.
You just might be right, Mr. Beale.
And there you have it, an audio tribute of just some of the films directed by Sidney Lumet. Sidney Lumet, one of my favorite directors, died on April 9th at the age of 86. Hopefully he is or he will be one of your favorite directors as well. Well, until next time, go see a Sidney Lumet movie. We all deserve it. I'm Matthew Soucy. Thank you for listening. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!